Welcome. My name is John Stone. I'm at the University of Illinois.
I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University. We're here today to talk about Thomas Rickert's Ambient Rhetoric, The Attunements of Rhetorical Being, a book that came out recently on University of Pittsburgh Press
in 2013.
When I think of a normal book review that I see in a journal that I hold in my hand in print, I expect it to kind of walk me through each of the chapters. I expect it to praise the really good stuff and make connections to other scholarship on the topic. And I think we're going to do some of that. We're trying to let people have a sense of what some of the important parts of this book are, but it's more than that too, right?
Exactly. I think what we're hoping to accomplish here is to attune listeners to the fact that this is a sonic experience, that you're listening to our voices rather than reading our words. And in fact, Kyle and I are both interested in sound and rhetoric, and so we're going to try to bring our particular interests to this book and talk really about the ways that Rickert and his book Ambient Rhetoric provide tools for us to do the work that we love to do. And I think that's kind of the conclusion. We're revealing the end in some way here. But the conclusion that we both came to, I think, is that the language, the approach, some of the theoretical concepts that Rickert comes to in Ambient Rhetoric really do lend themselves well to thinking through the ways that rhetoric is related to sound.
Right.
...2013 was a big year for me and you, Kyle.
Absolutely.
We went to a concert together.
We did. And even though this is a book review in a sense, we want people to get a sense of some of the important stuff here. I actually am really hoping we'll talk about Pearl Jam.
last summer, Kyle and I had the opportunity to go see Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field, which was kind of awesome. And it's an amazing opportunity to see this iconic band from the 90s. We both grew up in the 90s.
Well, and it was awesome in a lot of ways, and when I tell the story, I always say, man, it was just so amazing. And yet, I think there were a lot of ways that it didn't feel awesome in the moment. Right? We both had some trouble getting there. There was, oh, by the way, that massive storm that kept us there till 2 a.m.
Yeah. All the while being serenaded by this music that has meant so much to us, or used to mean so much to us as kids.
For sure.
And also being in this really iconic place on Wrigley Field. The stage was set up in center field, right underneath the green scoreboard that is so well known. Kyle and I kind of got onto the field and looked around, and there were thousands of people there, many in like Pearl Jam shirts from like 1992 when they saw them at Lollapalooza in Phoenix, Arizona.
Totally.
And then also kind of peppered by Cubs fans and yeah, baseball t-shirts and the workers at Wrigley, most of whom who were probably over 60 years old, all of us were there to experience this concert.
And they brought that place, the band brought that place very purposely into part of their performance after the very long, how long was it, 3 hours?
Well, there was a rain delay, which they had played for only like 8 songs. And all of a sudden this huge storm was supposed to come. It actually didn't come for an hour and a half after they promised it would be there. It was a rain delay. Very baseball.
Very baseball. And after that rain delay, they started the second, I want to say second half, but it was much the second two-thirds by introducing a song written at the request of Ernie Banks, a legendary Cubs player, written at his request about Wrigley Field, about the Cubs. And they sang it in that place. They invited Ernie Banks to stage. Ernie said, here is the baseball glove that Eddie Vedder bought here when he was 5 years old, when he was growing up in Evanston, Illinois, around the corner, and now he's taking it back. So it was interesting how all of these places were brought into the musical event, brought into the communication from the stage and the fans, and we couldn't forget it. It was clearly part of what was going on.
Right. And I've been to a lot of shows up in Chicago, living in Champaign, Illinois right now, and none are as memorable as this Pearl Jam show, mostly because the expectations that I had about the show actually weren't met. I went thinking I was going to have one experience and had a completely different one. And that difference has meant a lot to me related to the kind of the meaning of the show afterwards.
And meaning is a very, that's a word that gets us towards the book.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was thinking about. We were thinking about, you know, an experience that we had both had together that lended itself well to thinking through some of the concepts of this book. And this Pearl Jam show really does that in a lot of ways because of the emphasis on the sounds that were happening there, the people, the relationships, the place, both the place being Wrigley Field is kind of a place in Chicago that a lot of people gravitate towards who are baseball fans. But also, and Kyle mentioned this, Eddie Vedder's kind of deep embedded histories, the histories that he had, familial histories with Chicago, with the baseball stadium. And
he called the stadium the crown jewel of the planet at one point. And he's kind of building up, saying this is not only one of my favorite cities to play in, but this is the crown jewel of the planet itself.
All right. At the risk of making this too much about Pearl Jam and not enough about ambient rhetoric, what was rhetorical about this experience? There was something about this experience that lended itself well, as we were both reading ambient rhetoric, to thinking through some of the concepts that Rickert introduces there, concepts like ecology, attunement, embeddedness, and just this idea of ambience itself, because that night it seemed like that the concert that we were experiencing was way more than just the typical experience of going and listening to, you know, a band that you like play songs.
Right. And it clearly wasn't rhetorical in kind of the classical sense of it, unless we're saying what were the rhetorical strategies that the band used to help us create the meaning that they wanted us to. I mean, that doesn't quite fit here. It's more complicated than that. There's histories and material and emotions and all these things that were in this big, crazy, messy ecology that led it to mean the experience that it meant for us.
Right. If anything, the rhetoric kind of inhered around this idea of expectations. Like, there were certain expectations about what seeing Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field would be like. Something else was going on that was causing us to have and react in certain ways. And certainly it wasn't just us. We were there being with thousands of other people with similar expectations, but also ended having an experience that couldn't have been anything else, but was completely different from what we expected.
Right. And that experience wasn't designed by anyone, right? That was undesignable. It was a sense of, if we can turn to some of the book's language, I think it was a sense of the world disclosing itself to us. And by the world, I mean all of those things we were talking about. So even with that whole story, we haven't said anything yet about what this has to do with rhetoric itself. So let me turn to an interesting quote from really early in Rickert's book. This is from the preface or the introduction. There's an introduction and a preface. This is the introduction. He writes that rhetoric must diffuse outward to include the material environment. Things, including the technological, our own embodiment, and a complex understanding of ecological relationality as participating in rhetorical practices and their theorization. Help me unpack that a little bit. I think it's important.
There's a lot there, isn't there? But I think that this will also help to kind of structure our review, because these are the things that I think that we're the most interested in and excited about. I think what's most interesting in this particular definition is not necessarily the way that it's different from classical rhetoric, but the way that it builds upon it, the way that it encourages a broader understanding of what we mean when we talk about rhetoric. Rickert is really good throughout the book in bringing in all kinds of other things that are often overlooked in the typical, I guess it's Aristotelian approach to rhetoric, that rhetoric is the ability in any given situation to find the given ways of persuasion.
And kind of control that, right? And kind of to kind of chirotically assume a control over I don't know, what people experience, as if we could.
Right. So it's in other words, the rhetoric kind of has this almost godlike control over the environment, rather than the environment participating in, or the human rhetor being just one part of a complex group of associative things and people and places.
Yeah, well, and tell me if this is a stretch, but the way you're talking, that sounds very sonic. It sounds like the sounds that I make in any place at any time are always enmeshed in the other sounds around me, right?
Right.
So no matter how much we try to get rid of the material traces of everything we're involved with, we're still there. We're still enmeshed. We're still part of an ecology. And I think what we're seeing, the reason us two are interested so much in this is because ambient rhetoric is bigger than just sound, right? It's bigger than just music. It's more about the way that everything about a world discloses itself to us and changes us, partly through human action and partly through non-human, is action the right word? I don't know.
Sure.
But I think it also especially applies to sound. And I think that's why parts of this especially have gotten us really excited.
Exactly. And I'm even kind of having fun listening to us, although we're both kind of nervous, I think, trying to talk about these concepts out loud.
Seriously.
But we're working on it. You know, I think these are some new, there's some new vocabulary here that Rickert provides for not just scholars of sound, but he provides vocabulary, concepts, and kind of, it's an ambient theory, isn't it? For scholars of rhetoric who are pushing on the boundaries of some of these traditional ideas about what we generally and typically hold up as our theories of rhetoric.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that the couple of other reviews I've seen of this book are both non-traditional. I'm thinking of Trisha Campbell's review in Acculturation.
I'm going to offer an ambient.
I'm going to do
something else.
Remediation.
I'm going to offer
review.
And the interview Nathaniel Rivers had with Rickert in a couple of breweries in St. Louis in Cairo.
I am here with Thomas Rickert. I'm, of course, Nathaniel Rivers.
And I think there's something about these ideas that are attracting people who want to see rhetoric intensified. I mean, that's Rickert's word, right? He wants to see rhetoric intensified, not abandoned, or persuasion intensified, not abandoned. I'll make sure I say that right. So there's something that we, it draws us to play, and it draws us to go beyond kind of this traditional word stuff. I think that's the thing that rhetoricians are really good at saying. Oh, you know, we want the multimodal, and we want all these interesting new ways of creating experiences for people. But I think we don't have a lot of that. So there's something here that's an invitation to that.